Hi there, and welcome to another one of my podcasts. If you mention the words sex symbol, everybody now thinks of Marilyn Monroe, but she didn't start the whole thing. Before her, just before her, was the wonderful Rita Hayworth, who sadly, towards the end of her life, and she only lived to the age of 68, was one of the first times we heard the words Alzheimer's, because she contracted this condition when she was about 60. Horrible way to end one's life. She came of a very interesting parentage. Her father was Spanish, and her mother was sort of English-Irish, and her mother wanted her to be an actress, her father wanted her to be a dancer. She ended up as both, of course. She was born in Brooklyn, in New York, in 1918, at which time her name was Margarita Carmen Cancino. She definitely was Spanish, wasn't she? Little Margarita was given dancing lessons from the time she was about three. She didn't like it very much at first, but it was her dad, so she went along with it. And before long, she became pretty good at it, and at the age of eight, was already in a little tiny film made by Warner Brothers. And this was 1926, just before the real beginning of sound film. In 1927, her father moved to Hollywood, starting a dancing school there, and for a while did quite well. Taught James Cagney, Jean Harlow, but then he lost all his money because during the Depression nobody wanted to take dancing lessons anymore. However, she started dancing as her father's dance partner, and they went to Mexico and danced there, and she gradually got noticed, and at the age of 16 got a little part in a film, and as you can imagine, these things gradually developed until she became the film star that she did. She used her mother's original name, Hayworth. Where Rita came from, I'm not sure, but that's how she ended up being known as Rita Hayworth. She, of course, was known for doing the famous song Put the Blame on Mame, her most famous film being Gilda. But this is another one, very similar and of its time. This is called The Heat Is On. It's from a film that she made in 1953 or thereabouts, which may explain why the sound is rather muffled for its time. It obviously came off a soundtrack and was put onto a 78. This is the wonderful Rita Hayworth, who danced with Fred Astaire, sang and made a lot of American men very hot under the collar. Rita Hayworth, The Heat Is On.
She taught school in Kansas City. She was cold and rather grand. So at all the local parties, she was not on one made grand. But she read a book and then came the transformation. She announced one night to people's consternation. Heat is on, heat is on. You better not get near my lips tonight. I've got a kiss like a flame. And if you touch my lips, you might ignite, and you would have yourself to blame. The heat is on, the heat is on. I wanna know if men are men or might the one wither on the bough. I might have formerly been cold as ice, but I'm a forest fire now. Got an awful lot of oats that haven't been sown. They might start a chain reaction and I might explode. The heat is on, the heat is on. You're gonna hear the sirens howl tonight. You're gonna see the building bounce. Because the lady's on the prowl tonight, and it behooves me to announce the heat is on. You're gonna see the building bounce, because the lady's on the prowl tonight, and it behooves me to announce that the heat is on.
Rita Hayworth. Rita Hayworth, who incidentally had as busy a life off-screen as she did on-screen. She must have been wonderful for the gossip columns of the newspapers. She married, what, 5 times. She married Edward C. Judson, the famous Orson Welles, Prince Ali Khan, Dick Haymes, the singer, and somebody called James Hill. And these were marriages between the years 1937 and 61. And that was it, apparently, after that. She'd had enough of men. Well, looking through the list of people I've played to you over the months, I'm amazed not to be able to find records by the great Dmitri Smirnov. Smirnov was born in 1882 and survived until 1944, which means he only lived till his early 60s. If anything, he was the greatest Russian tenor of them all. He once indeed had to stand in for Caruso when Caruso had vocal problems when he was on tour in Russia. He was born in Moscow, studied with somebody called Pavlovskaya and somebody else called Alexander Dodonov. Well, whoever they were, they certainly gave him a wonderful technique. He could sing Russian music, Italian music, just about anything, and make it sound right. In 1904, Smirnov, at the age of 22, became a member of the Bolshoi Company, of course, singing there until 1910. He then sang at the Mariinsky Theatre in St. Petersburg until the Revolution. He sang abroad, he sang in the Paris Opera in 1907, and wherever he went, he was a success. Though possibly in New York, where everybody loved Caruso and McCormack, he had less success with Americans. It took a while, Americans, to get into Russian singers. Even Shalyapin had problems with America, particularly back then. In 1914, however, he performed in the famous Russian seasons at London's Theatre Royal Drury Lane. Didn't return to America till the mid-20s. Luckily, his voice stayed pretty much as it was, and he lived long enough to make electrical recordings, although they are rare compared to his acoustic recordings. In 1929, having no longer lived in Russia, he was able to return to the Soviet Union for a concert tour. Giving his last recitals during the 1930s, he taught singing in London and in Greece, in Athens, and then finally retired to live in Riga, which was then part of the USSR, now it's Latvia, where he died during the Second World War, only 61, as I say. I think he was maybe the greatest tenor of them all. He had a wider range than the great Leonid Sobinov, who was purely a lyric tenor, and Yershov, who was more of, I suppose, a dramatic. Smirnov was, a lyrico spinto and could sing just about anything, and a wonderful tenor. So I'd like to play you some Russian music because at the end of the day, there are many tenors who can sing the Italian repertoire. Even people like Caruso never quite were at home with Russian music the way Russian tenors are. Russian tenors have got a certain sound to the voice, a wonderful sort of melancholy in the actual tone of the voice. This is the famous Song of the Hindu Guest. Sometimes it's sung by Italian sopranos, but I think it's meant to be sung by tenors. Here it is in the original Russian, and you don't get it better sung than by Dmitri Smirnov, here recording in 1929.
В каменных пещерах не счесть жемчужин море полуденном далекой Oh. видел много каменных пещер, не счесть жемчужин море полуденном, далеко Индии.
The great Dmitri Smirnov. I often wish that I could get in a time machine and hear singers of that caliber. He really was something spectacular. Dmitri Smirnov, the great Russian tenor. Well, this is completely different because I don't know much about this singer at all. Her name was Alma Jones. She was obviously a singer of some quality in terms of her voice. She was a contralto. I don't know whether she ever sang either comedy on the music hall stage or whether she ever sang in opera. I haven't heard about her doing either. I have the feeling she was one of those people who sang ballads and other popular songs of the day. As such, she was signed up by not Edison itself, but Edison Bell Cylinders. This was an England-based cylinder company as opposed to the Edison Records, which were originally at least in the USA. You'll find quite a few people on the popular stage recorded for Edison Bell. I don't know much about her, but I do know about the song, because it's one of those songs that somehow you seem to know and don't know why. It's called Soldiers in the Park. It turns out that it was written by Monckton, who was a very famous writer of the day, alongside a gentleman called Lionel John Alexander. And it was a hit song from the musical that came out originally in 1898, a musical called A Runaway Girl, a musical which is completely forgotten as far as I know. The song, however, lives on, and it's one of those songs, as I say, you think, why have I heard that before? It's a wonderful tune, and it's beautifully sung by this unknown singer, at least unknown to me. And when I heard this cylinder, I was immediately struck by it, and it stays in my memory, so I wanted to share it with you today. When was it recorded? My guess is within about 5 years of the song coming out, so we're talking certainly the first decade of the 20th century, possibly the first half of it. It's only a short recording, somewhere around 2.5 minutes. So without more ado, here is Alma Jones singing Soldiers in the Park.
The popular song, Soldiers in the Park, sung by Miss Alma Jones, Edison Bell Indestructible Record.
Oh, merrily they
And from a cylinder, let's zoom forward 30 years to the electric era and the heyday of British dance bands. People of my generation will remember Billy Cotton for what was pretty much a fairly cheesy radio and TV show where he relied on Cockney humour as much as music. But in the early days of the Billy Cotton Band, it really wasn't a bad dance band at all and was obviously very influenced by American black music. In fact, at one point they even had a black trombonist and tap dancer called Ellis Jackson amongst the people working for them. Well, the record that I'm going to play you was made in 1934 and was obviously a take on the Cab Calloway hit The Man from Harlem. In the original version, The Man from Harlem was actually not Cab Calloway, but some mythical person who came in and was very sexy, but also sold drugs. In the Billy Cotton silly version, somebody is pretending to be Cab Calloway and they will make fun of him and they say, "You're not the man from Harlem." The band plays pretty well, perhaps slightly too fast to stop it swinging the way the original version did, but nevertheless, when this music was fairly new then, this is a pretty good attempt. Billy Cotton himself was quite an interesting person. He was born in Smith Square, a place that I know because there's a sort of defrocked church, which is now a concert venue where I've performed. It's near the river, just north of the Thames. He was born to Joseph and Susan Cotton. He became a choir boy, but then decided to become a drummer. He joined the Royal Fusiliers by lying about his age and actually fought in World War I in Malta and Egypt, and even Gallipoli, the famous failed campaign there. He then managed to learn to fly, and flew Bristol fighter aircraft all before the end of 1918. He flew solo, apparently for the first time on the very day that the Royal Flying Corps became the Royal Air Force. He was not yet 19 years old. Before he became a band leader, he was actually a bus driver and all sorts of things. And the band that he started, as I say, started off playing dance music, but then went towards rather sort of lowest common denominator comedy, with a singer called Alan Breeze, who stayed with him for years and years and years. But let's not worry about that. Let's go back to the early 30s and hear the Billy Cotton Band at its best, playing The Man from Harlem, 1934.
A terrible sight. If you listen, boys, I'll give you all a lowdown.
Yeah, man.
Now, drinks were served, six bits to throw, and everybody was feeling kind of low. Waiting for me, you see that man from Harlow.
Hey, wait a minute. Now, listen, boy, you make us stand. In fact, we think you're raving mad. You try to tell us that you're the man from Harlow.
Ain't I the man from
Harlow? Get away, man. I'll give you such a jab. You try to get us at your cab, you ain't. Because he's the guy from Harlem. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Now listen, boy, what I'm telling you, because every doggone word is true. When I say that I'm that man from Harlem, I want you boys to give me a chance, but I got no ants in my pants.
Oh, no?
You can't mess about with that man from Harlem.
Swing it, boy.
Cotton, born the same year as Duke Ellington, which puts him in historical context. Well, you can't get much further away from what Billy Cotton was doing there to the very patrician, haughty, proud, that's the impression you get of her anyway, diva, and for once the word seems very appropriate, the soprano Emma Ames. She was one of the very first generation of famous American sopranos who dominated the Metropolitan Opera before the turn of the 19th, 20th century. That said, she was actually born in China, of all places. She was the daughter of an international lawyer and was therefore born in Shanghai, which is where he was obviously stationed at the time. But of course she returned to America and was brought up in Portland and a place called Bath, not the one in England, but the one in the American state of Maine, where indeed I believe she's buried. Emma Ames was obviously a person who had the rich things of life available to her in her early years, and thus her singing voice was noticed pretty early on and was given singing lessons as a small girl. Later on, however, she took voice lessons with the most famous singing teacher of them all at the time, Mathilde Marchesi, and that was in Paris. The voice itself, as much as we can tell from those old recordings, seemed to have been quite a rich soprano with a lot of bottom in the tone quality. Probably due to Marchese's influence, she made her professional debut in Gounod's Roméo and Juliette in Paris at the Opéra in 1889. She left the company, however, in 1891. In 1891, she made her debut at the Metropolitan, again as Juliette, and she quickly became a favourite with the Met audiences, and she carried on playing there till 1909, in the course of which she undertook a tour which took her to San Francisco in 1906, and thus she was, along with Caruso, there when the great earthquake took place in that city, and she was lucky to survive without any problems. She was also a favourite at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, where she sang in the last decade of the 19th century and established herself as a real rival to Nellie Melba before Tetrazzini did that a decade later. And apparently, there was no love lost between the two divas. Ames's last operatic performance was in the 1911-12 season. She carried on performing till about the beginning of World War I, by which time her voice was going off a bit. And you can hear her not only on the Victor recordings that she made, but also in the legendary Mapleson Cillas, where you can actually hear her singing bits of Tosca live. She wasn't a great beauty like Geraldine Farrar was later, but as they say about her, she was a handsome woman, had a good stage presence. She knew her worth. She married Julian Story, a painter, and later the baritone Emilio de Gorgorza, but both these marriages ended in divorce. She had no children, but later once admitted that she'd been pressed into having an abortion. Why and under which circumstances, I don't know. After retiring, she moved back to Paris for the 20s and early 30s, but finally New York City in 1936 was the place that she returned to, where she became a singing teacher and passed on, no doubt, part of the Marchese tradition. The one thing that I find unusual about this time is that she apparently used to like to go to see Broadway shows for relaxation, the one thing that doesn't seem to fit the image I had of her, so maybe I'm being unfair to her. Anyway, she survived World War II, but after World War II became gradually ill and died in 1952. At the age of 86. This is a recording of her singing the great aria from Cavalleria Rusticana, Voglio Saperte. Fine vocal quality, no wobble, no mistakes compared to other versions of this particular aria. So we're here in 19th century singing here, and it's wonderful. Emma Ames. Oh, Emma Ames. And finally, we're going to go to the same era, but to a very different form of entertainment. I have played one record of the great Burt Williams before. He was born in the Bahamas in 1874, a year after Caruso, and indeed died a year after Caruso. So their lives were simultaneous, if you want, but of course their careers were very different in nature. He was so well regarded that 20 years later, of course, and I played this on an earlier program, Duke Ellington wrote a piece of music called A Portrait of Burt Williams. He was one of the first black performers to make a black man look dignified, even though he was using his character for comedic purposes. It was always sophisticated and never pretending that a black man was somehow stupid. And his accent certainly isn't the typical quote-unquote black accent used by people who were in blacked-up coon shows. Indeed, some point in his life he was asked whether he would have preferred to have been a white man, and his reply is very interesting, because he said, most emphatically, no. How do I know what I might be if I were a white man? There's many a white man less fortunate and less well-equipped than I am. In fact, I've never been able to discover that there was anything disgraceful in being a coloured man, but I've often found it inconvenient in America. So he said what needed to be said many, many years before, of course, civil rights in the 60s gave black people the rights they should have had all the time. Nevertheless, he was a very successful performer. Born in the Bahamas, he then migrated to California with his parents, met an early partner in a double act called George Walker, who died later because he contracted syphilis, and then he went on his own and became a huge star. Some of his records sold anything up to 150,000. And this is a good decade before black singers were becoming well known on the series of records known as race records. Here he is then. This is a particularly apropos track to play because we're going through the general election as I record this. This is a lovely record, one of his very last that he made in 1920 about somebody quitting his job because it was too hard and wasn't being paid enough, reminding one of what's going on right now in England with the 0 hours jobs and the low pay, which is one of the subjects of the current general election in England. Here is then Burt Williams at the height of his powers performing I'm Gonna Quit Saturday.
Of just keep on walking up and down all these railroad tracks with sometime 15 drunks hung on my back, so I'm going to quit. That was a Saturday. They've got a habit around here of late of ordering me out to help with the freight. Now, Sunday, the circus is due in town. Yes, and there's going to be a lot of freight hanging around. Now, they told me way here last Monday that I've got to help with the freight on next Sunday. Of course, when they make you work on the Sabbath day, they always give you some sort of little extra pay. Now, there's going to be lions with that freight. And I see no sense in me tempting fate. So I'm going to quit. That's a Saturday. Show as show can be, I am going to quit on Saturday. Let's take that straight from me. Of course, this Sunday pay, that's nice and sweet. But my better judgment tells me be discreet. Because I know that lions really love dark meat. So I'm going to quit. Yes, sir. Saturday.
Bert Williams, two more things to mention. In 1903, he came all the way over to London to perform in the Royal Variety Show for King Edward VII, which he was very proud of because he still regarded himself as British, being born in the Bahamas. Also, one of his best friends was the great W.C. Fields, who later said something very interesting about him. He said he was the funniest man he ever met and the saddest, which must tell you quite a lot about his personality and character. Well, it's almost time for my track. Before I do so, I did actually sell 5 of my operatic records this month, but there are a lot more. So please look on the link, www.erlokin.com/78forsale.html. I'll put the link here because I really need the space. And I've got this wonderful music which you can actually play at home in much clearer sound than will ever be on this podcast. So if you do like 78s and you like opera records, here's a chance to get some of the best recordings ever made, and cheaply. I'm not a dealer. Well, it's time, as I say, for my own track. This one, I found one I don't think I've played you before. This was one of the very early, in fact, the earliest attempt I ever made at trying to write a bossa nova. I hadn't quite got the rhythm right. The song itself isn't too bad, but it's not proper bossa nova yet. But it was a good early attempt. I was, after all, in England, not Brazil, and still only about 19 or 20 when I wrote this song. This was recorded in the studio of Dick James, the studio in which the Beatles used to record their Christmas messages for their fans. And he got in some of the best session players around at the time to accompany me. So this is my song, written for a friend of mine at that time called Adrian May. So I called it in her honour, Adriana. And, well, here's the song. I hope you enjoy it. And until the next time, as always, au revoir.
Adrienne, kiss it so light. Adrienne, dreams in the night, bright and as fresh as Maytime. But as she goes swaying by, the music seems to Adrienne, fountain of bloom. Adrienne, breaks all the rules. They are but fools who gaze on her, for none will gain the heart of Adrienne. Thank you. breaks all the rules. They are but fools who gaze on her, for none will gain the heart of Adrienne.